All right, welcome. Today I have an incredible guest for you. I'm so excited to share. Years ago, I read this book called Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. And it was written by today's guest. His name is Chip Conley. The book related various aspects of business, specifically the relationship and experience customers have, the relationship and experience employees have, and the relationship with investors to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, Abraham Maslow, in a way that I found extremely compelling. I'd never heard before. You know, these days, it's not uncommon to hear conversation around creating meaning in work with employee relationships and recognition, to create lasting legacy relationships with investors, and to look for what are the unmet needs of customers, you know? But back then, when he wrote this book, I mean, he was way ahead of his time from my perspective. And he has been that way for many of his pursuits. He's a true visionary in every sense of the word. So real quickly, Chip originally built what became the second largest boutique hotel company in the country before selling it to Hyatt. It's now become a Hyatt brand. It's called Joie de Vivre. He then was recruited by, at the time, the very young founders of Airbnb, which was a small company then. But he was instrumental as an advisor to both the founders and other executives in helping to build Airbnb into the, you know, huge global success story, incredible success story it's become. And I recently saw him speak and was so excited, having been such a fan of his work for so long, as to what he was up to now. And he's at it again, having founded something called the Modern Elder Academy, where he's helping people to rediscover and redefine what it means to go through the midlife transition and live with deep purpose and meaning throughout our entire lives, in a way that I don't think is kind of the normal story we tend to think of in here, in this country anyway. So today we talk about so much. We talk about how happiness is reported very differently at different ages and how it's actually not what you would expect. People that are older tend to report being happier than I expected, certainly. And why that is, you know, what is it that changes? What goes into major transitionary periods in life? What are the elements of a transition and how to go through transition gracefully? I mean, you know, I have two young kids, my wife and I, 5 and 7, I feel like I wake up every day and they're older and things are different. I mean, change is all the time, omnipresent. I mean, we happen when I'm recording this right now to be going through a global contraction, you know, change is everywhere all around us. And Chip has a lot of wisdom about going through transition as he's gone through a lot himself. We talk about the effect that ego has, you know, on our development and transition through life. And I don't know, I think in recent years, I have realized that my ego is like a very young version of my personality. It's like a 12 or 13 year old kid version of me that wants so badly to protect me, you know, from everything. But also, as part of that, wants me to fit in, or wants to help me fit in with everyone else's story, everyone else's perspective on how things should be. Wants me to be liked by everyone and all that sort of thing. Now, this part of my personality is wonderful. It's an ally, it's helpful, and trust me, when things hit the fan, I want my ego to jump up and sound the alarm, but I don't want it in charge all the time, you know? And I think if it had its way, it would be in charge all the time and be the alpha. And it's just not the alpha. And life isn't as good when it attempts to be. And what I've found for myself at least, by recognizing this part of me as such, is that there's something deeper behind all of it, which is a deeper wisdom. That's the best way I could describe it. And anyway, so we talk a fair amount of that about that today. I don't know if that frame is helpful for you, but it's been helpful for me. We also talk about Modern Elder Academy, this project he's currently working on, and a brand new project that he's just started, which came out recently, called Generations Over Dinner. I think we all know that a lot can be learned from different generations, but Chip contends that, you know, young people can learn just as much from older generations as older generations can learn from younger generations. And this project is designed to bring generations together to learn from one another's perspective and insight and experience. And it's really pretty amazing. So Chip is just filled with wisdom. He writes a daily blog called Wisdom Well, which I read every day, and I've learned a lot from it, and so much more. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. I mean, it's packed with practical advice and really interesting insights. And one other thing before we jump in, for a long time, for 16 years now, I've been part of a company called the Oxford Club. And as we all know, right now we have very high inflation. We're going through a period of economic contraction. And it seems like, or it feels like, there's a lot of fear out there. Well, the Oxford Club is a business that recommends specific investments, ideas, what, you know, specific stocks, what price to pay for them. And these are very well-researched companies. I use these recommendations to manage my own family's money. Of course, I'm a little biased, but I very much believe in this, you know, to the point where it's worked very well for me. And the main newsletter is like the cost of a magazine subscription. It's very inexpensive, and it gives you specific guidance on how to build a portfolio, what specific stocks, many of which you probably will not have heard of, and what price to pay for them and so forth. And again, I've used this myself, and the track record has actually beaten the S&P average by more than double, by more than 100% over the last 20 years. So the results do kind of back things up. You can also just join. There's a free e-letter called Liberty Through Wealth, which is costs nothing, and it creates essays or insights, which are published 5 days a week, about the current state of the economy, the current state of the markets. And you can find both of these at www.richlifeguy.com/Oxford Club. Again, www.richlifeguy.com/Oxford Club. Finally, if you like the podcast, I'd so appreciate your tapping the subscribe button and or leaving a review, both of which are so helpful in, you know, growing the following and getting the message out there. So, all right, without further ado, I bring you the amazing Chip Conlon. Thank you. All right, Chip Conlon, thank you so much for being here. It's really great to see you.
Honored to join you, Nathan.
So, I thought we could start today with a concept that you're the first person I've ever heard articulate this concept, and it's become very meaningful to me personally, but it strikes me as a concept that really is relevant to anyone at any age. So let me just ask you, what is the happiness U-curve and how do you think about it?
Well, fortunately, I didn't just come up with it on my own, but in fact, I did a lot of research, and social scientists for the last number of decades have been looking at what are the ingredients of happiness or life satisfaction in various parts of the world. And one of the things that they've studied is the idea of how does your life satisfaction increase or decrease over the course of time. Now, I think the societal narrative on aging is that, once you hit your midlife crisis, it's all downhill from there. But in fact, the data is quite the opposite. It shows that actually people do hit a difficult period in their life. Your mileage may vary. Nathan, you're not there yet. 45 to 50 tends to be the roughest era in someone's life across almost all cultures. But actually, after that low point, with each passing decade, people get happier and happier. So 50s happier than 40s, 60s happier than 50s, 70s happier than 60s, and women in their 80s happier than 70s. And so it what it looks like is like a big smile, a U-curve, a big smile where life satisfaction drops starting at around age 22 and continues on down till for about 25 years. And then it actually goes back up for 25 or more years. And I, what's encouraging about this is it suggests, oh, wow, you know, your best years may not be behind you at age 45 or 50. Your best years actually might be ahead of you.
So what would you say? I mean, what about, you're right, I'm coming into what seemingly that low point. Yeah. Is this something that can be influenced? And if so, like, what advice would you give to someone that's, you know, leading into that low point?
I actually think millennials are helping to flatten the curve a little bit, which is a good thing. What are the ingredients that lead to that low point? I have a book called Emotional Equations. I'm going to pull out an equation from that book, and it's disappointment equals expectations minus reality. Disappointment equals expectations minus reality. It is around age, your mid 40s, that you start to realize the expectations you had of your life may not pan out. You may not have married your soulmate. You may not have $1 million in the bank. You don't have the job title you had expected, and your kids are a pain in the neck and not as successful as you wanted them to be. And so you end up having to readjust your expectations, which is not the end of the world, but it is, for some people, that's what's going on. So actually adjusting expectations along the way when you're younger is a good thing. Another thing that happens around age 45 to 50 is people realize that they have been reading from a script that was handed to them by their parents or their community, and is not really their script. They were not the screenwriter of their life. And it is around 45 or 50 that they say, hell, I don't want to live this way. I want to live a different way than this. And that's when, you know, sometimes the midlife crisis kicks in with like the red sports car or an affair. But if you actually along the way are checking in when you're younger about taking a path that feels right for you, you're likely to avert that. Another thing that actually happens often in people's 50s and 60s and beyond is they care a little bit less about what other people think of them. They don't personalize things quite as much. And so learning how to do that at a younger age where you don't care as much. And now this is a hard one a lot of times for younger people, especially in a social media era where everybody is so worried about likes and, you know, how many followers do I have, et cetera. All of that works to your disfavor because quite frankly, getting to a place where you're comfortable in your own skin just as it starts to sag is a good thing. Because it actually getting comfortable in your own skin is a form of developing life satisfaction. And it means that you sort of take your own path. So I could continue on for a while, but I would say those are some of the ways that a person who's younger than 45 to 50 could help to make sure their dip isn't as deep as it is for some people.
Thank you. That's really helpful. It's, you know, it's interesting because I think young entrepreneurs, oftentimes social media is a key part of their business strategy. So finding the balance between keeping, you know, minimizing social media, but using social media for a purpose that can be beneficial is a tightrope to walk.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, most of the people listening probably have heard of you, but for anyone who hasn't, and I'm sure there are some, can you just talk a little bit about what's your background? What's, you know, how do you think about your work and your background up to this point?
So I grew up in Southern California, went up to Northern California to Stanford for college and stayed there for business school. I got my MBA there, went to work for a real estate developer. And then at age 26, started a boutique hotel company in the very early era of boutique hotels starting to become a thing in the hotel business. And the name of my company was called Joie de Vivre. It was based in San Francisco. And over the next 24 years, as the CEO, we created 52 boutique hotels around the state of California, each with its own name. And we became the second largest boutique hotelier in the U.S. Sold the business. It's now a Hyatt brand under the name JDV or Joie de Vivre. And then at age 50, I was like, what's next? And 2 years later, I was approached by the three young founders of Airbnb about 10 years ago. It was a tiny little tech startup in San Francisco. I really didn't know much about it. Most people in the world had never heard of it. And as it turns out, the timing was perfect because I had the time and they had the need. And the need was nobody in their company, their small company, had any background in hospitality or travel, those industries. And they were going to disrupt those industries. And so I came in as what they ultimately called me, the modern elder, who is as curious as he is wise. That's what they said to me, who helped them take their little company, which was growing fast when I joined, but didn't, you know, they'd never run a business before. They were, one of them was a Harvard engineer. The other two were Rhode Island School of Design designers. And I helped them, along with some other people who joined us, to build their business into what's today the most valuable hospitality company in the world. Along the way, while I was doing that, I was 4 years full-time with them, three and a half years as a strategic advisor. So 7.5 years, very actively involved. Along the way, I started to see that this modern elder thing was really interesting. Why is it that we think of people as being over the hill at age 50 or 52 or when I joined Airbnb? And what if we were to create the world's first midlife wisdom school? And that's what we did, called the Modern Elder Academy. Our first campus is down here in on a beachfront in Mexico in what's known as Baja California Sur, an hour north of Cabo San Lucas. And it became such a hit that we now have two campuses opening in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we have an online program called MBA Online. And it's become a big deal and gotten a lot of attention, you know, and I'm thrilled because I, you know, midlife can be a period of time. And midlife, thinking of it quite broadly, sociologists now consider midlife 35 to 75, which is a very long period of time. Wow. Midlife is an era that hasn't gotten a lot of research. The only thing it's gotten is a bad brand. When I say the word midlife, what's the word you add to it?
Crisis.
Midlife. Exactly. Crisis. And in my opinion, based upon a lot of research that we've done and working with academics, it's really not a crisis. It's more like a chrysalis. And if you think of a chrysalis, it is the in-between stage between a caterpillar and a butterfly. And if you think about the U-curve of happiness, the low point of the U-curve of happiness is right there in midlife. And it is when you're sort of in this gooey, dark time, a lot going on, a lot of transition happening, a bit of a metamorphosis potentially happening. On the other side of it, it often are your happiest years. And so that's what we've done is we've really created a program that allows people to reimagine themselves. And with the average age of people being 54 years old in the program, if you're going to live till age 90 and you're 54, you have as many years of adulthood behind you, 18 to 54 is 36 years, as you have adulthood ahead of you, 54 to 90 is 36 years. Mm. Most of us at age 54 do not think we are halfway through our adult life at age 54.
Right. I love that. I really do. I love that. So do you find that, well, first of all, I will be coming down to visit you in Baja at some point, but do you find that people really have very different trajectories? Like someone can go through a midlife crisis literally at 35 or all the way up to 75.
Yeah,
and those,
for sure.
And what does that depend on?
Multiple. Yeah, I think, I mean, what are the reasons? There's so many reasons. I mean, some of it could be going through a really difficult time. Let's just call it a difficult time. What a guy named Bruce Feiler, who wrote a book called Life is in the Transitions, called a life quake, when you're going through multiple transitions at once. There are a lot of reasons why people have challenging times. One is often the primary operating system of their life is changing. And, you know, what got me here is not going to be what gets me there moving forward. And that's hard. It's hard to make a transition in the middle of one's life. Sometimes there's things that are thrust on you. You're surprised by, you know, your spouse asking you for a divorce. One of your kids passes away unexpectedly. Empty nest is harder for you than you thought. You have an illness or disease that's discovered at this age. You know, men have andropause, women have menopause, and that hormonal transition is hard. So there's a lot that goes on. What I think is true, and it's unfortunate, is that we as a society understand that there's a big mashup of different things going on in midlife. And yet we don't really provide anything in the way of societal or social or government support to people in this era, unlike adolescence. Now, adolescence as a word was coined in 1904, didn't exist before then. Hmm. And so it's interesting. And then prior to that, you know, if you hit puberty, you were an adult. But once adolescence as a life stage being thought of as a life stage in between childhood and adulthood, your teen years was coined as a concept. It led to child labor laws, led to public junior and senior high schools as we know them today in a mainstream kind of way. Well, there's a new word called middlescence. It's about 20 years old. It's not well known in the mainstream. And it's a word that describes what's happening when you're going through physical, hormonal, identity and emotional transitions in midlife, similar to what happens. It's sort of like the bookend of adulthood. The start of adulthood is adolescence, just before it. The end of adulthood before elderhood is middlescence. It usually ends around age 60 or 65. And after that, you are an elder in a sense that you're not elderly. You're relatively speaking, maybe older than the people around you a lot of the time. And yet we don't have much in the way of a society, schools or tools or rituals to help people to go through all of the transitions that happen in that middlescence period. And that's really what we're doing.
Mm. All right. I love that. And I want to come back to this, but if we could just for a second, you mentioned chrysalis before as just a metaphor for periods of change. And it just strikes me that that metaphor is, would you say, and do you think about it as applying to any period of change? Like, for example, right now, you know, I think a lot of people are worried about the economy or wondering, you know, where we're headed in the next year or two. And these periods of crisis, how do you think about chrysalis related to any?
Well, let me actually, rather than using chrysalis as the metaphor on this one, let me just use some scholarly research that has shown the following, is that the effective way to go through any kind of transition is to consider it as three phases. The first phase is the ending of something. And it could be ending of a mindset. It could be ending of, you know, a job and moving on to something else. It could be the ending of an expectation. At the ending of that and then ritualizing that is important because, frankly, if there's something that you're holding on to moving forward and it's not going to happen, you know, there's a lot of lingering disappointment, and it may inhibit you from moving on to what's next. So the first stage in any transition is the ending of something. The middle stage, and for the caterpillar, it is, you know, ending being a caterpillar. The middle stage is what's also called the messy middle. It's a period of liminality. Bruce Feiler in his book, Life is in the Transitions, based upon research he had done, shows that the average length of a transition, it could last 4 years. And now, you know, transitions in the economy don't last 4 years typically, unless something really serious is going on. But our emotional relationships to what happens in the economy might last 4 years. Mm-hmm. If a business you have went out of business, it might take that long to just sort of get over it. So the messy middle tends to be a period where it's a more emotional period. It's like, okay. And it's also building new skills. Think of it like, you know, in the military, if you're becoming a recruit, there's the ending of your relationship in Kansas, Abilene, Kansas, with your family. You go off to Quantico, Virginia to become a Marine, and you go to boot camp. You get your head shaved. You're wearing a uniform. That's the messy middle. You're going through all of the hell week of boot camp. And then on the other side of boot camp is you go back to Abilene, Kansas to see your family. You have a newly shaved head. You're wearing a uniform. There's maybe a new gentlemanliness to you. And you show up as a different person. Now, Joseph Campbell, with The Hero's Journey, is the first person to sort of like popularize this notion. And then George Lucas took his notion and applied it to the Star Wars movies. The idea that this transition of the ending of something, the messy middle, and then the beginning of something new. And I think if we were better as human, as in a society, to help people understand those are the three stages of a normal transition, we might have people going through the transition more adeptly and more quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sometimes people are waiting for the end of something to allow themselves to feel happy, yes, content, you know, and the reality is that this day is going to happen one time and we'll never have it back. And so what would you say, how would you describe a rich and fulfilling life? Or how do you think about that question?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things we talk about at MEA, Modern Elder Academy, is we say that we're in the business of long life learning. Mm. What is long life learning? Is that like lifelong learning? Well, lifelong learning is a big umbrella, and you can be doing it lifelong learning at age 30 or at age 70. But the difference is that at age 30, what you might want to learn, mm-hmm, how you learn it and why you learn it may be different than at age 70. As you get older, long life learning is learning to live a life that's as deep and meaningful as it is long. And so that is why long life learning is a subset, often for people 50 and older. And the topics that you might want to learn about are different. So what makes for a deep and meaningful life? Well, according to Dr. Phil Pizzo, who ran Stanford Medical School for a long time and then started the Stanford Distinguished Careers Institute, he says the three things people need more than anything else after age 50 are purpose, community, and wellness. And so let's unpack those. In the Harvard longitudinal study done by George Valiant has shown this as well. So often when someone retires, for example, they often lose the first two, purpose and community, because a lot of your purpose comes from your work. Mm-hmm. And your community is also often the workplace. So it's not surprising that when someone retires, they might actually lose that sense of purpose and community. And it's something you need to actually be more intentional about in terms of how you bring it in your life. The part that's always really surprising to me is wellness. Like, if you're retiring, why would you necessarily be less well? You'd have more time to go exercise and be healthy. Right. But because you don't have the structure and discipline of work, actually you end up spending 47 hours a week on average for the average retiree in the United States in front of the television.
Is that right?
And so these are the three things that I think help to create a longer, deeper, meaningful life. But a piece that is sort of missing here, and it could fall under any of these categories, purpose, wellness, or community, is spirituality. And I think a faith. And there's no doubt that as we get older in life, on average, we tend to get more curious about these kinds of spiritual matters. In fact, it was the psychologist Carl Jung, as well as Christian mystic Richard Rohr, who actually is very involved in MEA, who said that the first half of your life, your primary operating system is your ego. And the second half of your life, adult life, the primary operating system is the soul. But nobody told you this. Mm. And there's a shift in the operating system around midlife. And yet we give no operating manual for people to understand how to make this shift. And that's, I think, a really important part of the MEA curriculum and a long life learning kind of curriculum anywhere would be, how do you start asking some of the more mysterious questions of life in a way that is going to be a North Star for you? And we don't, at MEA, we don't have a particular doctrine or dogma that we are behind. We are big believers in the idea of mindfulness, which is a great way to say between stimulus and response, you create a bigger space. And mindfulness helps you be less reactive, no matter what, you know, your religion or spiritual practices, that is a good and healthy thing. But we also have a huge library of all kinds of books from all kinds of spiritual and religious paths that people tend to gravitate to and say, you know what, I studied philosophy in college, and the last time I actually read any interesting book around spirituality was then. And I want to, I'm now 55 years old, and I'm curious again. So
I would say that in my own life experience, my bookshelves have shifted as the years have gone on in that direction. Yeah. So like, what are the obstacles you know, what do you think are the biggest obstacles to a rich and meaningful life? And it's, I'm hearing what you're saying, which is the happiness U curve. I mean, is ego death or just sort of realizing that ego is running your life? Like, what are the obstacles that you see for younger people, I guess, and then for older people?
Yeah, I think an obstacle is your ego getting the best of you, so to speak, meaning you're not, you're so self-focused that you lose track of what you can do for others. I mean, one of my favorite questions to ask myself and anybody else who's in doing whatever they're doing is like, how can I serve? How can I be of service? And, you know, I'm a big believer in the servant leadership path in organizations as well. So I think the ego is one thing that gets in the way. Another thing that gets in the way is, as I said earlier, worrying too much what other people think about you. And that's partly because at times you have no control over that. I mean, there are times when you can influence it for sure. But you know what? I'll never forget in high school, there was a woman named Jeannie. And Jeannie said to me, "I hate you, Chip." And I said, "Why do you hate me? What did I do?" She says, "I hate you because everybody else likes you." I was like, "Okay, what am I going to do there? Like, okay, if the reason you hate me is because everybody else likes me, then there's nothing I can do about that." And it was a beautiful, you know, at age 17, way for me to say, you know what? Sometimes it doesn't really matter what someone else thinks of me. Another thing that gets in the way of a deep or a rich and meaningful life is being overly busy. It is a natural, especially for those of us who are very type A, myself included. If you constantly feel like your sense of self-esteem is a function of how busy your calendar looks to yourself and others, you don't really give space for something to emerge. So for me, let me use a quick example. When I sold my company in the Great Recession, the boutique hotel company, and I had a couple of years and people were saying, "What are you going to do?" And I was interested in a few things and I was writing a book and I was doing a bunch of things, but I didn't like jump on one bandwagon. And I'm glad I didn't, because when the Airbnb founders approached me, I had space in my life. Now, originally it was supposed to be 15 hours a week. Within three or four weeks, it was 15 hours a day. But thank God I had the space to be able to do that, because what a rocket ship I attached myself to and what a journey I was on. And if I'd kept myself too busy, when that opportunity came along and emerged, I would have said no. So learning how to slow down, learning how to spend time in nature, because nature is a beautiful teacher for all kinds of things, is another thing that could be helpful. And then I think finally, I would just say the following. This is directed toward men more than women, because women learn how to socialize and to be vulnerable early in life. And they have a social safety net, emotional insurance from friends. Men are not so good at this. And it is part of the reason, you know, I had five friends, all of them in midlife, take their own lives through suicide during the Great Recession, during 2.5 years. That was really hard. And so what I would say is learning how to build the muscle of being vulnerable and having friends who are there in your life and you're there for each other. There's a reciprocity. And to have a rich and meaningful life is to really understand what's going on with your closest friends. It's having deep conversations. There's a beautiful, Arthur Aaron is a psychologist and he has 36 questions. So if someone were to do a Google search for Arthur Aaron and the last name's Aron, so it's four letters, 36 questions, you'll see them. And they're the kind of questions that if you were to sit down with your best friend or, you know, someone who you cared about, a family member who you wanted to get closer to, it's a beautiful set of questions to actually create greater vulnerability and intimacy with someone else. And once you've opened the door to that, as we've learned at MEA, wow, you realize that you want all of your relationships to have that deep and meaningful component too. And the Harvard study, the longitudinal study of what makes people live longer, happier lives, showed without a doubt the number one ingredient was the quality of the relationships someone has invested in their lives.
Thank you for that. And yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes here. That's a really great resource. I of the people that I know who are in midlife and who are feeling frustrated or lost, most of them are overweighting their work. And, you know, maybe they have a very busy family life, but they're not weighting heavily their relationships. So that, yeah, that's extremely helpful to me and to, I'm sure, a lot of people listening. So, yeah. So thank you. So, I mean, you've of course been through many ups and downs in business, and I know you've learned an awful lot, and you've also had a lot of success. What have you learned in your life about financial wealth? Like, what's the value of financial wealth? What can it give you? And what can it give you?
Yeah. One of the questions we like to ask here at MEA is, what would be a growth mindset associated with money? And not in terms of how do you grow your money, but how do you improve your relationship with money? So one of the questions we like to ask our students here is, if you went to think of money, what if money was a person and it was your best friend? And you and money went to couples counseling together or therapy together, what would money say about you and what would you say about money?
Yeah.
And so I think learning to be a little more conscious about our relationship with money is really important. Does money actually give you freedom or does it take it away? And I think, you know, up to a certain point in someone's life, money-wise, it absolutely gives freedom. It helps. There's no doubt. The data is pretty conclusive that up to $75,000 or $100,000 a year in annual income, more salary income annually increases happiness. Interestingly, after a certain point, it used to be $75,000. I think it might be $100,000 now. And of course, it depends on where you are in the United States,
right?
Because, you know, $100,000 in New York is not the same as $100,000 in Waco, Texas. The fact is that there's no correlation between income and happiness. And that's partly because at a certain point, money can take away freedom in the sense that when it actually becomes the measuring of your self-esteem, or people are greedy or are feeling somehow that there's a bad relationship with money within a family. You know, people see money as the thing, a scarce resource that, you know, leads to arguments, when in fact it may not be that scarce. So I think financial wealth is, you know, something we all obviously should, I think it's worth striving for. In my opinion, it gives you the freedom to make decisions for yourself, your family, as well as your philanthropic life of what you want, how you want to create the currency. So Lynn Twist is a famous MEA faculty member. She wrote a book called The Soul of Money. There you go, right there. So The Soul of Money, and she teaches with me down here in Baja. And she talks about the word currency. She says, like, let's remember that money is a currency, and we think of it generally in the financial terms of, like, okay, well, you have the US currency, you have the UK currency, you have the German currency. But she's like, no. Currency means something that actually goes, it's like a conduit. And there's something energetic about it. It creates the bonds between things or people. And what she likes to say is that, you know, how will you use that relationship, that currency, in such a way toward how do you use your money to support that in the world that you want to see more of? What do you want? What you appreciates.
Right.
I like that. And it, you know, it's led me, for example, I made a small fortune. I'm embarrassed to say it, but I made a small fortune, like not even a small fortune, but a large fortune, being one of the larger shareholders of Airbnb. And what that allowed me to do is to take that money and create a foundation for myself, Chip Conley Foundation, and it allowed me to create another, you know, nonprofit called AGE, Association for Growth and Education, that allows me to fund programs for midlife education for people. But it's allowed me to grow MEA. So that's freedom to go and say, I want to use it the right way. Now, there are days when I, you know, get into arguments with financial advisors. I mean, the more money you have, the more there are, somebody has an idea about how you should be using this money. And that's when it gets a little complicated. Especially if you have descendants and people who are looking to you to be the money bags for their future. So it is not a simple topic, but if we can start with intentionality, you know, how are we more intentional about that relationship with money, the better our relationship with money might be.
Those are very, very helpful ideas. Have you found for you, I know, you know, yourself first and foremost, but a lot of other people who have been successful financially, have you seen patterns between them? Like, have you noticed patterns that lead to financial wealth, or are there any patterns that you look for or use when you're making decisions, financial decisions?
Oh, I wish I had my t-shirt on here. My Warren Buffett t-shirt. I have one. I wear it occasionally. You know, who's swimming naked when the tide goes out. And that's sort of a time we're in right now with, maybe recessionary times. I'm a big believer in, you know, buy when other people are selling and sell when other people are buying. I mean, it's so, you know, bet the bottoms. People have a tendency to overestimate how long a positive period is going to be and overestimate how long a negative period is going to be. And the trend lines over time are pretty clear. I mean, so I'm a big fan of looking for undervalued stocks because they are, which I think actually Airbnb is right these days. It was overvalued and now it's undervalued, and somewhere in between is the right number. I'm also a contrarian by nature in terms of how I start businesses and run them. I, you know, why run a business where your competitive set, you're just trying to be as good as they are? You know, why not change the playing field in which you're playing on, which is what Airbnb did and what we did with the boutique hotel business, and frankly what we're doing with MEA as well. And so I'm generally not somebody who believes in following the pack.
Yeah, I think it's especially important right now. We also there's a friend of ours or a friend of mine that is a family planner. You mentioned this earlier, our descendants. And one of the things they first do when they meet with clients is they bring together, if possible, three generations, as many generations as exist. And they bring those generations together and they have them go through a process where they come up with a purpose for the money over time. And they get them to all agree to this. Cause I mean, you're right to this. I mean, how many families have just fallen apart, frankly, when money's passed on?
Right. Yep.
So anyway, thank you for that. So, what's a belief that you once held back in your hotelier days? You sold your hotel in 2008.
The hotel company sold in 2010.
What's a belief that you held back then that you have let go of since then?
I mean, I think one for sure is that back then I saw my sense of self-worth being almost absolutely correlated with the success or failure of the business. And I look back at that now, you know, 12 years later, and I laugh at it. You know, I think that's a funny thing, but I also realized that age 26, I ran it from age 26 to 50. So in many ways it was just where I was at age 26. It just sort of stayed there. What's another belief that I had back then that I don't have today?
Or one that you still have, or one that you had back then that stood the test of time. That's still really important.
Your reputation is the most important and intangible asset you have in your life, whether that's a brand or whether that's a person. You know, your reputation is portable. The cosmic bellhop delivers it to your destination before you get there. People will talk about you. So I would just say that's one that I stands the test of time for sure. I think, you know, in the era of social media, it's maybe even more important because it used to be word of mouth. Now it's word of mouse, not even word of mouse anymore because nobody uses a mouse. But it's like there's an element of like the digital bashing of a reputation. It can be really painful because of the fact that it goes so far. I mean, in terms of how quick and widespread something can be. So I think that's important. I have a blog called Wisdom Well, which I think you know. And I had a blog post a few weeks ago on the 62 pieces of advice. I'm 62 this year. 62 pieces of advice I wish I'd learned earlier. And there are a bunch of things on there, but one of them on there was assuming best intentions. For me, that's one that's pretty core. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are bad people in the world. Yes, there are people who are going to rip you off. But what a more generous and beautiful life I live by being clear that I assume best intentions. When it is a decision I have to make that is a what I call a below the waterline decision, mm-hmm. like if a torpedo hits the ship, it sinks, then I'm going to come from a perspective of more caution about assuming best intentions. But when I run into people on the street, when I meet people for the first time in a workshop, when I am introduced to somebody by an email, I generally assume best intentions. And what I see in return is someone doing the same for me.
Mm-hmm. Oh man. Yeah. The intentions matter more than anything. I think you're right. It is a really tough way to live your life when you're going around and just assuming the worst in someone's intentions. Yeah. I literally had right before our call just now, I had someone cut me off and seemed very upset with me. This type of thing mm-hmm. used to bother me. And, I've learned to think about it very much like you described, or at least I'm trying. So, anyway, so thank you. Let's turn back to MEA. Mm-hmm. what's one of the most surprising insights that you've learned now that you've spent time with all these attendees of the Academy?
Well, our curriculum has five components to it. The umbrella we're a midlife wisdom school, so it's helping people to cultivate and harvest their wisdom. Okay, that's the first point. But the four pillars of our program are reframing aging. And I think one lesson there is like how much we talk about ageism, but some of our ageism is inside of ourselves. Yeah. So we, you know, like I hate looking at myself in the mirror. It's a senior moment. And we say things about ourselves that are, you know, they may be a joke, but in some ways they're, you know, it's toxic about thinking about aging. And, you know, Becca Levy from Yale, her work has been fascinating, which she's shown that when someone moves from a negative to a positive perspective on aging, they gain 7.5 years of additional life. That's amazing. And so I think helping people to see how they can shift their mindset on aging. Secondly is mindset. Carol Dweck's work at Stanford on how to popularize the idea of mindset, moving from a fixed to a growth mindset. I think one of the things that we've learned at MEA is when people have a fixed mindset about things, they close down their options. And it's no wonder they're in their 50s or their 60s and they're sort of like depressed and cranky and sort of, you know, shouting at the world because they've sort of lost the ability to learn how to try something new and become a beginner again. The third curriculum pillar is navigating midlife transitions. And we've talked about that earlier in our conversation today, but you know, how to understand that transitions have a natural flow to them of ending, messy middle, beginning. And then regeneration, that's the fourth pillar of our program, regenerating ourselves and a planet and society and a community. I think that what I would say is that if there's a number one lesson I've learned is how thirsty people are for community, how thirsty they are for deep, meaningful conversations. And so I'm excited that later this summer, we're going to be launching something called Generations Over Dinner, which will be a global program of people learning how to have conversations over dinner across generations on topics that are, you know, intriguing, whether it's faith and spirituality or it's work or it's solving huge vexing societal problems. Learning how to have a conversation again, because you know, in some ways we shout at each other through social media, and there's almost a generational gap that exists in some ways. So helping to foster really deep, meaningful conversations is something we're excited about.
So where did that come from? Where did that idea originate? What prompted you to?
It originated because we have a guest faculty member named Michael Hebb, and he created a program called Death Over Dinner. The idea of the taboo of talking about death. Yeah. What if you had six or eight people around the table and there were three or four different topic sort of pillars you could go to and say, we're going to talk about grief and somebody we've grieved in the course of our lifetime. And let's go there. And here's five questions on that. And so Michael, over a million people did Death Over Dinner around the world. And so Michael, being a guest faculty member of ours, said, well, what if we turn this into a Generations Over Dinner conversation? Where might that go? And so, so that's what led to it, is just, you know, somebody on our faculty who'd done it very well for death, the topic of death.
Is the Death Over Dinner something that happens at MEA?
He has a workshop called Love, Death, and Human Connection. That's this October, Michael Hebb does. But we don't do it in a normal week. But it is a program. You can Google it and find it. We don't do it over dinner on a normal week. But what we do is we have a conversation about death in our normal week, you know, and about how death is a fascinating organizing principle for life, which is why those people are saying we're going to live forever. You know, it's like, okay, so what is there's a real challenge psychologically, existentially, if you know you're never going to die. I don't know. I mean, I'd be fascinating to me. What are the psychological implications of that? But we have yet to get to that point where anybody's proven that happens.
Right. But it would certainly affect. So for anyone considering either their midlife or, you know, getting older and thinking about this concept of being an elder, I mean, I love this idea that you know, if you have two generations, there's curiosity between the two, and one can learn from the other and their experience, and the other can learn from the youth. And how would you encourage people listening to this or watching it to think about that dichotomy and the opportunity there?
Well, I would just say there's lots you can read about and then lots you can expose yourself to. I mean, we'll have the Generations Over Dinner program live, globally starting at the end of this summer in 2022. If you want to learn more about what it means to become an elder, you can read my book, Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. If you wanted to understand more about MEA and how our programs, which are not only here in Baja, they'll be in Santa Fe soon, but we also have online programs, 8-week courses on purpose and on transitions. You can find all of that at modernelderacademy.com. But I think the number one thing that's really simple for someone to do is just like follow my blog. It's free. It's Wisdom Well. You've enjoyed it, Nathan. And it's a great way, you know, I do ask questions. There's sort of big, deep questions in the blog. It's a very short blog. You get, if you subscribe to it, it's free, and you get an email every morning. Mm.
Okay, beautiful. And the Generations Over Dinner program, those are actual physical dinners that are being coordinated.
They're physical dinners. Exactly. So, you know, we'll probably start doing the press on it after Labor Day.
Perfect. All right. Well, we'll link to all of this. Last question before we close here. What's something that you secretly wish people would ask you more, but they don't?
What do I wish people would ask me that they don't? How was midlife for you, Chip? And I got to say that I had two sides to midlife myself. One was really bad and one was really good. And we talked about it today, but I'm going to encapsulate it here and say between 45 and 50, that bottom of the euchre of happiness, I went through a really rough time. It was really difficult. And so I saw the dark side of midlife crisis. And yet then at age 52, I joined Airbnb, and in my midlife, all of a sudden saw the upside of midlife chrysalis, the idea of, like, you know, on the other side of the chrysalis is the butterfly emerging from the chrysalis. And my emergence really was as that modern elder, which, if you'd asked me a few years earlier when I was going through my difficult time, was that ahead for me? I would have said, of course not. I have no idea what that you're talking about. What is a modern elder? So I guess for me, I would say, you know, sometimes there's an upside, sometimes there's a downside, there's an upside around midlife. If you can get through the downside, you may be able to find the upside, helps you to find it. It's the best time of your life.
Okay. Thank you so much. That was really, really wonderful. And you shared a lot of really important, valuable insights, resources. That was really helpful for me too. So personally,
thank you, Nathan.
Thank you as always, Chip. And I will link to everything that you mentioned here. So people that are, anyone who's listening, please find Chip at WisdomWell. Is it wisdomwell.com?
You can actually just put WisdomWell and Chip Conley and in Google, and it'll show up.
It'll bring it for you. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your time again.
Thanks, Chip. Nathan. Great to see you.
You too.
All right. Before you go, if you liked what you heard, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast player. And if you enjoyed the conversation or any other, please leave a review. It's the single best way you can support the podcast, and I would be so incredibly grateful for your support. So thank you so much. I hope this was a good one. And until next time, this has been Rich Life Lab.